It's Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on the show, we'll meet a captain of the Madeline Island Ferry. He'll talk about his work in our Hidden Wisconsin segment.
But first, let's take a look at some activity out of the state. Joint Finance Committee this week, it made tweaks to the governor's estate recovery program.
It's a program that was expanded in the state budget, but members of the Joint Finance Committee raised concerns about the plan.
Here to help us sift through the changes and what this thing is Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, when we heard this news story here, we thought this needs a little more detangling, I think, to figure out what's going on. First of all, what is the estate recovery program?
I mean, this is something that the state has had for a period of time, prior to the Walker administration, that helps them recover the money that taxpayers pay, some of it, to put, elderly people who can no longer care for themselves into nursing homes or give other long-term care. And what the Walker administration did, essentially, was to expand under state law the ability of government to go and recover those funds from the families of people who have been put into nursing home care under Medicaid.
And so Medicaid is paying for this long-term care. The idea is these families, in some cases, have assets that they could have been using instead of Medicaid. Is that what the concern is and why we have this law?
Right. So, correct. The state and federal taxpayers pay for long-term care for people in nursing homes through Medicaid. Now, obviously, those people, to qualify for Medicaid, you already need to be deemed needy by the rules that govern that program. But nevertheless, there can be assets that a couple or an individual can have and retain when they go into the nursing home. And one example is a situation where you have a spouse who goes into a nursing home, passes away. You have the remaining husband or wife who, continues to live for a period of time and then may also pass away and then leaves an estate. And so a lot of these rules look at, what rules come into play when that estate is divvied up and they decide, does the government get it? Do the heirs of the couple get it? Those are the kinds of questions that are being dealt with.
So it's not the case that, as you mentioned, when the first spouse in long-term care passes away, they go to the widow or widower and take the house away. That's not the goal of the program?
Right, right.
That would be unpopular, I think.
Right, right. I mean, it should be clear that the surviving widow or widower would still have some ability, if they had not gone into a nursing home themselves, could still have some ability to keep some assets. But it is worth noting that if they remarry and then pass away, it may affect whether what their new husband and wife are able to retain in terms of assets and what might go to the state government.
And it also would affect what children would inherit in this instance.
Certainly,
right?
Yeah.
And that's probably the biggie,
isn't
it?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the two edges of this are, we do have this program at the state level that does give people the reassurance that their parents or grandparents are being, taken care of, even if their relatives are unable to do it. But the other side of that is that, yes, I mean, for, say, a family, a farmer and goes into a nursing home and perhaps a son who's worked with him for his entire life may be hoping to inherit or even purchase the farm and continue to earn his or her livelihood from that property. And, these new rules could certainly affect situations like that.
That's been part of the criticism that it might break up a farm or other small business entity.
Right. I mean, that would certainly be one of them. And that has been a criticism that has been leveled at it. The response has been that, given the rising cost of health care given and long-term care, given the fact that we will have more people needing that as the baby boomers age, the response is that if people have assets have a means to pay for all or some of their care, that they need to be doing that.
And this has been in the news this week, as you mentioned. The program's been around for a while. They were kind of tweaking it related to this marital property issue. Was this a really significant change, or is this a fine print sort of change, but that still would have gotten in the way?
Sure. The way this worked is the existing program to recover assets was changed by the state budget that passed at the end of June, and that was your big change. But lawmakers required the Walker administration to come back, and before those changes were implemented, they're already part of state law, but before they're implemented, to get the go-ahead from the legislature's budget committee. The committee largely gave that go-ahead yesterday while making some tweaks. One of the things that is really unusual is certain parts of the law yesterday, the budget committee said would not be implemented, that the Walker administration could not implement them. But those areas, those statutes remain on the books. So you have this odd situation in which the laws cannot be enforced by the Walker administration or implemented by the Walker administration, but there are still the laws present. So there's a question then of what does that mean to, you know, private entities like banks and trusts and entities like that that help people who are, you know, transferring assets from one generation to another. What does that mean for them? Are they obligated to still follow the law, even though the state itself cannot? It's an unusual situation.
It's a twilight zone for a state
plan. It's a legal limbo. It certainly is.
And when is this something that when it's fully implemented, it means, okay, starting now and on into the future, this is in effect? Or is it somehow retroactive to people who would have applied to even before the law was passed? Or is that clear at this point?
I want to be careful here, Rob, because I just want to, I mean, I really should emphasize that if anyone has a specific situation that they need to look at, that probably the best thing for them to do is going to be, you know, seeking, you know, to reach out to both public agencies as well as private legal counsel that can help them, because these things are so complicated. You know, and that's probably where I had better leave that one.
Sure. So this was not without controversy, mostly Republicans in favor of these changes, mostly Democrats opposed. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Although it's important to note that there were two Republicans who voted against moving forward with this change. It was Senator Sheila Harsdorf from River Falls and Senator Mary Lozich from New Berlin. And they both had concerns that what was passed by the budget committee yesterday still went too far, or that there were too many unanswered questions about it. So, you know, it would not be a huge surprise if the legislature comes back and revisits this, because there are some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who are unhappy with it right now. And there are also, you know, some pretty significant state associations like the State Bankers Association that has voiced some very serious concerns about how this will play out for them, how much it will cost to, you know, implement the changes, and whether or not there's sufficient, the law is clear enough to allow them to do that.
Moving ahead, joint finance signed off on it. Does that mean, is that the go-ahead the Walker administration needs, or is this a thing where it goes through the committee and now the whole legislature has to pass it again, more or less?
No, I mean, it's certain. No, they can. The Walker administration can move forward with those parts of it that the finance committee approved yesterday. So, you know, the majority of the changes, to my understanding, will move forward. But, you know, I think both those changes, as well as the things that weren't approved yesterday, could be revisited, you know, in the coming months by lawmakers who want to see if they can improve the product.
Jason, thanks so much for helping us sort that out.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Coming up, it's the latest installment of our Hidden Wisconsin series. Meet a man who keeps the ferries running in Bayfield.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time for another Hidden Wisconsin segment where we take a peek at jobs people do in Wisconsin, things that we might take for granted.
In this installment, we take a trip from Bayfield to Madeline Island, and there's really only one way to do that, on the ferry.
Mike Radke is a U.S. Coast Guard licensed mariner, marine operations manager, and a longtime captain on the Madeline Island ferry line that runs between Madeline Island and Bayfield. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Well, how did you get into the life of a Lake Superior ferry pilot?
Well, that's a... Now, after, you know, being 56 years old, I have to think back and think, where did it all start? But it really started with my family falling in love with the Bayfield area back in the early 70s. And we had one of the first small sailboats in the Apostle Islands Marina when it was brand new. And I became a kind of avid sailor at the time, and that led me to want to kind of stay in the maritime field as a career. So, you know, one thing led to another, and here I am.
This is probably a pretty much a landlubber's question, but what exactly does the captain do?
Well, plenty. And, as, you know, I'm a captain and a manager, so I've got to be careful that my crew, that I cover everything, because my crew would, you know, say, well, we do a lot more than that. But
sure.
Obviously, we, you know, navigate the ferry back and forth between Bayfield and Madeline Island. But being that we operate a vehicle passenger ferry, we deal with lots of different types of loads of traffic from passengers, of course. But then we also deal with all the different types of vehicles that travel over the road. And we basically handle anything that can legally travel on the highway systems. And we've had, you know, we carry semis and cement trucks and everything you can imagine that has to get to a community pretty much travels with us. So it's a job with a lot of responsibility as far as, of course, passenger safety and then the loading and safe loading and unloading of the vessel, which is done basically every half hour when we are on our summer schedule.
Now, I've seen that summer schedule. It is a lot of back and forthing between Madeline Island and Bayfield. Does it get old going back and forth, or are you always just happy to be out there on Lake Superior?
Well, you know, I like in any job, I think there's a certain routine that you can't, you know, that you probably at times you wish you didn't have to deal with. But, you know, every day is different. The weather is different. Customers are different. The loads. So those add challenges and interest. I think our crew has a pretty good relationship with each other, and they, you know, enjoy their work. So going to work with the people you enjoy being with is not such a burden. And, you know, I had somebody ask me that same question once, and I said, well, I'm sure orthopedic surgeons some days just go in and say, I just don't want to have to repair that knee. You know, I'm tired of doing knees today. So we all have our routines and our jobs, and we learn how to, you know, get through them. But overall, I think, you know, we're on just an incredible piece of a big lake. You know, it's just an amazing place with beautiful sunrises and sunsets and changing weather. So there's plenty to see, and I think that's what kind of keeps us going.
Well, Lake Superior is pretty famous for being temperamental, especially, you know, in the autumn storms before it freezes over. Have you ever been on a ferry ride when the weather's kind of rough?
Well, I have, and certainly all of our captains have. You know, I kind of downplay that a little because I think Lake Superior sometimes gets an undeserved reputation. Of course, everybody knows about the Edmund Fitzgerald.
It's Gordon Lightfoot's problem.
Yeah.
It's that song.
Exactly. But, you know, the majority of the time, the lake is not that rough. But certainly in the fall is when we do get the roughest conditions. And those are challenging times. It's just something you have to deal with. And, you know, we take safety pretty, very seriously in our company. And there are times when we just say, you know, it's just too difficult conditions and we're going to shut down for a period of time. Usually it's just a matter of shutting down for a few hours, letting things settle down. But there have been those occasional times where we've actually shut down for the majority of the day. The challenge is not so much actually being on the water. It's actually coming in for a landing. It's kind of like pilots on a plane. You know, once they're in the air, that's not the most difficult time. It's when they're landing and taking off. And so that's the same for our captains. They have the challenge of coming into a basically up against something that's hard with a very large vessel and doing it safely in conditions where there's a lot of wind and wave action. So that's what kind of forces our decision to, you know, reduce our schedule or shut down service if we have to.
Now, you mentioned the Edmund Fitzgerald, the ship that went down famously. But, you know, besides that, there's a lot of history that's gone on in Lake Superior. It's a pretty historic place where you live there. Are you aware of that as you go back and forth, that you're just part of this chain of maritime history that's gone on for a long time?
Well, we are. In fact, in our terminal building in Bayfield, we have kind of a very nice display of photographs of the kind of original ferries that first plied the water here. And, you know, interestingly, the ferries certainly went back and forth between Bayfield and Madeline Island, first just carrying passengers. And the first ones, of course, were sailboats, and, of course, before that, with the Native Americans and their canoes. But then the ferries actually played an important role in the development of the communities along the Shawamigan shoreline from Bayfield to Washburn to Ashland, because the road systems weren't there and the railroad really wasn't in. It was really the ferries that provided transportation between those communities and played an important role in their development. And then eventually the railroad came in, and then finally when vehicles became popular, the road system.
Well, tell us a little bit about, you know, what the 9 to 5 is like on your job, or maybe it's not 9 to 5. I know the ferry runs pretty late, but what is it like when you get up in the morning? If I wanted to be a captain on the Madeline Island Ferry, what would my life be like?
Well, first I'd like to say you're right. It's not a 9 to 5 job. I was on a boat this morning, actually, and I was there at 5:30. That meant I got up at 4:30. And so it's probably like being the host of a morning show on Wisconsin Public Radio.
So you're the Joy Cardeen of Lake Superior.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you get up early, you go in and you start getting the vessel ready for the day, which means a pretty thorough checkout of engines and systems on board. And then we make our first trip at 6:30 in the morning. And we carry commuters and workers who are going over. Usually the people that are going over that early are people that have to go to the island for a job or for some work of some sort. When we get to the island at 7 o'clock, the people we're bringing over again are commuters that are going to the mainland for work, and also the school kids who live on the island. From 6th grade on, they ride the ferry to Bayfield to attend school in Bayfield. So they're our precious cargo, I guess, at 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
And then from then on, it's you know, it's a variety of commuters and then visitors to the area who are going back and forth.
And what time does your day end?
Well, it depends on the time of the year, but it can end, like if it's a morning shift, for instance, your day would end somewhere around 2:30 in the afternoon. If you work a night shift, you could start up at 2:30 and work as late as midnight, and then Friday and Saturday nights you could work as late as 1 in the morning. So, again, there's these great opportunities for sunrises and sunsets, but it's not an easy, you know, it's not an easy thing. Shift work is hard work and demanding, but our crew does a good job of balancing that out in their lives.
How important would you say the ferry is as a lifeline for the people who live on Madeline Island?
You know, it's extremely important. And when you talked about the weather and shutting down for weather, of course, that's always a difficult decision for us, because we understand how important it is for people to get to their jobs, for the kids to get to school. So we don't take it lightly as to, you know, making that decision. And yet, of course, safety is the most important consideration. But it is a lifeline. We carry all of the materials, the things that people need, from food to fuel oil to propane, gasoline, and all the other things that are needed, and then, of course, the passengers. So, and you know, when it really becomes kind of the thing that the people most connect with, it's those people who live year-round on the island that have, you know, really depend on us, especially in the winter months and in the, you know, kind of the waning parts of our season. And our schedule gets quite reduced by then. We still run about 7 round trips a day, but we're not running as late into the night. And you know, we don't take for granted how important that is for those people who live there year round, to have that service and to have you know, enough frequent trips so that they can do their job and to do the things that they need to do, getting to doctor's appointments, those types of things.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but what's your favorite season to be out on the water?
Wow, that's a tough one. You know, I love fall. I mean, it's really amazing to be here in the fall and to watch the colors change. And every day you're out there and you look at the hillsides of Bayfield and out among the islands and see those colors changing. It's just a constantly changing palette. So it's hard to say that fall isn't my favorite time.
Yeah, right about now. So I hope you're having a good run of it.
Well, it's starting. It's late this year because of the kind of late start to summer. So the colors haven't really gotten, but I'm sure that around Apple Festival and maybe the week after, we're going to have some pretty spectacular color.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
That was Mike Radke. He's Marine Operations Manager and longtime captain on the Madeline Island Ferry Line that runs between Madeline Island and Bayfield.
If you want to be on Hidden Wisconsin or suggest someone, call our hotline, 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422.
Or post on our Facebook page at Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And coming up next after the news, we'll hear a Syrian-American perspective on potential U.S. involvement in Syria. Stick around. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Perez.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The Syrian civil war has been going on for a little over 2 years now.
After revelations that chemical weapons were used in Syria, the United States debated military intervention.
Since then, Russia stepped in to broker a deal between Syria and the rest of the world. Syria's agreed to give up its chemical weapons, and the United States won't intervene.
We'll get a perspective on that now. We've got Dr. Khaldun Alaswad with us. He's a cardiologist and an Appleton resident. He was born and raised in Syria. He's a founding member of PROMISE, a non-governmental organization that raises funds, provides humanitarian aid to people in Syria. Dr. Alaswad, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you joined us on the Joy Cardine Show a little while back, and you supported U.S. military action in Syria. With the news of this deal brokered by Russia, Syria giving up chemical weapons, have you changed your position?
Well, I have a problem with the whole kind of approach to the Syrian crisis. And as you know, and probably most of the listeners know, that the regime had killed more than 110,000 people with conventional weapons. And the regime used chemical weapons for terrorizing what he considered the social base of the rebels, or the social structure which supports the rebels, in order to just kind of push them into fleeing the country and become refugees in a neighboring country. So my position is not really built on just using the chemical weapons and that. My position has always been that the U.S. need to do something more as the superpower with the most moral standing and actually the only country with the capability of saving women and children and civilians in Syria. So my position has not changed at all. I still think the U.S. need to have a clear policy and it need to help the Syrian people obtain their freedom and dignity because, as you know, and as everybody knows, that it is still a revolution. People rising up against a tyrannical regime and the only ones of freedom and dignity like any other people in the face of the earth.
And the phrase civil war has been thrown around. We used it in setting up this interview. Do you think this is better characterized as a revolution than a civil war?
Absolutely. And in fact, it's kind of, this is the only thing the regime and the Syrian people agree on. It is not a civil war. And a civil war was characterized like this by the Red Crescent, earlier in, I think, in May or April of 2012. And I'm not sure about the reasons, but if you look at the definition of a civil war, which is people, like the same people or two factions of the same people fighting each other, this is not actually the case in Syria. What's been happening all along, it's a regime supported by foreign countries and by foreign groups, terrorist groups, I might add, like Hezbollah, Iran, Iraq, and Russia, are mainly killing and maiming the civilian population. Of course, the civilian population mounted its own military response after 8 months of being killed with no response. The people start arming themselves, and there is no match between the regime army, which has been trained and conditioned to do this for the last 4 years since Assad the father took over, and between rebels and who have basically machine guns at the most. They don't have any weapons to defend their neighborhoods from the air bombardment or even against the missiles. So it's mainly a revolution. It's mainly a people fighting for their freedom and dignity, and a regime fighting its own people and killing them with every weapon so far except nuclear weapons. And I'm sure if the regime has those, it would have used them.
The revolution, though, the revolutionary groups, there are a bunch of them, a bunch of different factions and organizations. And one of the, I think, hesitations from the United States government has been a concern that some of these groups cooperate with Al-Qaeda or other international terrorist organizations. Is that something that worries you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are good signs what's coming out of Syria. And if you heard the news yesterday, there was actually a confrontation that these terrorist groups, or these what we call jihadi groups, which is more affiliated with Al-Qaeda, they are really the minority in the rebel groups, and their objectives are exactly the opposite with the Syrian people objective. Their objective is to establish a caliphate or Islamic State in Syria, which will never happen, knowing Syria really well. Knowing the Syrian people really well, this does not happen. Syria is used to diversity, but there are actually now military confrontation between the Free Syrian Army or the Syrian people, represented by their kids, their sons, their daughters who are fighting the Assad regime. There are now in northern Syria, there are a fight broke out between them, and hopefully the Free Syrian Army, if it is well-equipped and if it's really supported by the U.S., will be able to topple the regime and rid Syria of those small but well-equipped minority. And this is the thing. When we left the Syrian people with no cover, when we left them being mowed down during peaceful demonstrations by the regime forces, and they left their neighborhood bombarded by surface-to-surface missiles from airplanes with no protections, those jihadi groups start pouring in the country and offering to protect the Syrian people. And of course, a country which had been deprived of any political discourse for the last 40 years. The people did not see behind what these groups at the beginning, but the people came to realize really fast that these jihadi groups are as exact opposite of their position. They actually, the Syrian people think they are actually even operated secretly by the regime itself. And that actually has its roots because the regime supported the formation of these jihadi groups and sent them to Iraq to kill American soldiers and Iraqi citizens all along since the U.S. went into Iraq in 2003. So the Syrian people are already mounting resistance to those small jihadi groups.
Speaking of Iraq, Colin Powell, before the U.S. intervention in Iraq, said the Pottery Barn rule, you break it, you buy it, you overthrow Saddam Hussein, and you've got to deal with the aftermath. And it was fragmented, difficult, violent. Wouldn't it be the same in Syria? Are American people who oppose the war right to worry about what happens after Assad is overthrown if the U.S. intervenes?
This is one of those actually unchallenged media so-called fact that likening Syria to Iraq. Syria is exactly not like Iraq, and so that is for several reasons. When we went in Iraq in 2003, there was not a revolution in Iraq. Now Syrian people have already risen up for their freedom and dignity, already shown that they are willing to pay the price for freedom and dignity. They already shown they paid more than 100,000 civilians killed, 8,000 children even killed by the regime, a lot of women killed by the regime. There are one-third of the Syrian population either refugee or internally displaced. Hundreds of thousands are in jail and under horrible conditions and tortured. This is actually similar. If we go help the Syrian people, it's similar to France helping us during the American Revolution. It's not like us changing the regime. If we go help the Syrian people topple this regime, it's going to be exactly like the French when they came helpless. Now, what's going to happen after toppling the regime? Is the U.S. going to own it? And I don't think so. Although I have to mention that Syria need all the help it's need in the world to kind of rebuild and reestablish the normalcy in their life. More than 50% of the schools are destroyed by the regime. That's one example. The Syrian people are already risen up to take matters in their own hands, and the Syrian people, the refugees around, actually the intelligentsia of the Syrian population is all willing to come back, but they're all under threat. The regime has been targeting physicians, engineers, lawyers, specifically those group of people to kind of deprive the country of their services and because they can't form a leadership for a political discourse. Those people, when they have the slightest chance to go back, they are going to take things in their own manner. And they're going to take things in their own hands, and they're going to probably be a good partner for the U.S. and the rest of the international community to rebuild Syria.
There's been talk as part of this whole chemical weapons deal of trying to bring a political settlement as opposed to a military overthrow of the Assad regime. Do you think there's room for a political settlement where Assad and rebel groups can sit down at a table together and work out a future for the Syrian government?
Well, the Syrian regime has lost every chance. In fact, it's actively killed every chance of political settlement. You have to know this regime has not practiced politics ever. It took power by military coup, and it's ruled the country by the security forces and the army forces. The regime did not allow any political discourse in the country. Assad, after committing so many crimes against the humanity, he knows that any political settlement will actually exclude him. Any political settlement will include at least justice for the victims of his regime, and that will include probably trying him or at least having him live in exile for the rest of his life. Assad has shown over and over again he is actually only paying lip service to political settlement and only pretending that he will actually sit for political settlement and go for Geneva, while on the ground continue to bomb civilian neighborhoods. Now, if you want to talk and say, well, the Russians are actually also interested, that's actually not true at all. If the Russians were interested in a political settlement, they would have forced the regime to release their allies who are actually political dissidents, peaceful political leaderships in the country, inside the country, who the regime been imprisoning for the last 2.5 years. The Russians did not even force the regime to release Dr. Abdelaziz Al-Khayr, who is a very prominent political opposition figure in the country, and he is actually the one who is engineering all these, trying to have a political solution in the country. So the Russians are basically, with this last chemical weapon deal, they're buying the regime more time. They have no objectives themselves other than basically sticking it to America. This is about Putin, is not about the Syrian people or about Syria.
Dr. El-Aswad, that's all the time we have. We'll leave it there for now. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Khaldun El-Aswad from Appleton. He was born and raised in Syria. He's a founding member of PROMISE, a non-governmental organization that raises funds and provides humanitarian aid to people in Syria.
Coming up next, we'll talk about an underground group in America, Mushroom Hunters. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're going to talk mushrooms now. I'm a mushroom fan, but the only place I go to hunt for them is the grocery store. Our next guest digs a little deeper to find out where the wild mushrooms we eat come from and who's getting them for us.
Joining us now is Langdon Cook. He's a writer, speaker, and forager, and his new book is called The Mushroom Hunters, On the Trail of an Underground America. And he joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Langdon, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, you're a self-proclaimed mushroom enthusiast. When did this obsession with foraging mushrooms begin?
I've been picking mushrooms for probably about 20 years, since moving to Seattle, which is a famously damp place and a great place for fungi. So, you know, I pick for myself and my friends, and I love to cook with mushrooms. But I also realized after picking for a number of years that there were others out there who were doing this on a professional basis.
Now, mushrooms are a hot commodity right now, and it's actually never occurred to me to wonder. I sort of thought there might be mushroom farms, which I now realize doesn't make a ton of sense with these wild mushrooms that you're talking about. Can you actually make a living off picking mushrooms?
Well, there's some people that are trying. I mean, several thousand, as a matter of fact. And you can move with the seasons in the greater Pacific Northwest 12 months out of the year picking wild mushrooms. So there is the possibility of doing that. And, of course, you have to be a great optimist. You have to be thinking that over the next ridge is the mother lode and that you'll strike it rich. And a lot of them are. And, you know, they pick mushrooms day after day and move with the seasons and camp in national forests and do what's known as the circuit or the mushroom trail, picking different species at different times. And so I got on the mushroom trail with them.
Now, these are wild mushrooms we're talking about. Can you run us through the list of what's out there?
Sure. And you had mentioned farm mushrooms. And of course, there are farm mushrooms. When you go to the grocery store and you see those little cute white button mushrooms, those are domesticated mushrooms that are grown in farm-like conditions. But the wild mushrooms are really special. They come in all sorts of different colors and shapes and sizes. And of course, they have different taste profiles. And so some of the better known wild mushrooms that you might forage would be chanterelles or porcini mushrooms, also known as king boletes. There's a one that looks like something that might wash up at high tide called a cauliflower mushroom with a wonderful nutty flavor. There's hedgehog mushrooms and yellow feet and lobster mushrooms. I mean, there's all kinds of different wild mushrooms, and they really are a fascinating, almost otherworldly looking sort of pantheon.
Now, in Wisconsin, we get probably the most excited about morels and also lion's mane I've had around here, which are really kind of fun looking. And you're out there in Seattle. Is Seattle sort of the place, the mothership for mushrooms?
Well, we're certainly right in the heart of it all. You know, from Northern California all the way up through Oregon and Washington and BC into Southeast Alaska and then east to the Yukon and down through Idaho and Western Montana, that's really the sort of, you know, that's the area where most of the serious professional pickers are working. But Seattle is certainly right near the top. And of course, a lot of mushrooms get exported from Seattle and Portland.
Now, you talked about the mushroom trail. Tell us what that is.
Well, so as I mentioned, it's the mushroom trail is a physical trail. It's the you know, the itinerant sort of path that the pickers follow as they follow the flushes of mushrooms through the seasons. But it's also in the book kind of a metaphor. Being on the mushroom trail is really finding a, sort of a different way to make a living. Living out in the woods, being in tune with the seasons, wandering around, looking for a type of food that, you know, we have no part in tending. This is nature is taking care of these mushrooms, and really our job is to go out and find them. And there's the rub. But I mean, the mushroom trail, as it's understood by most folks, is, as I had mentioned, the sort of road for mushroom pickers that extends from Northern California up through Washington and BC into Alaska. And those are the really prime picking areas. And of course, it's famously wet. And also, we have these wonderful volcanic soils out here, which seem to help with the fruiting of the wild mushrooms.
Now, you went along on this mushroom trail with a couple of guys who were really, they were the, I guess, pros at finding these mushrooms. Tell us who you went with.
So I met a picker named Doug, and he graciously sort of let me into his world. And, you know, wild mushroom pickers are famously secretive. And you hear all sorts of stories about secret patches and people claiming patches out in the woods and guarding them ferociously and all that sort of thing. But, you know, Doug was very generous with his information. And then he would sell his mushrooms to a particular buyer named Jeremy. And so between the two of those characters, I got kind of both sides of the coin, the picker and the buyer. And I spent a lot of time out in the field with both of them.
Well, tell us about one of the trips that you took with Doug.
Well, Doug and I have been all over the Northwest together, but we also we went down as far as Northern California a few times on what is known as winter pick. And, you know, while most people are, you know, kind of bundled up for the winter and shoveling snow and all that kind of thing, in Northern California, very temperate, you get these mushrooms fruiting, which land on restaurant, you know, plates through the winter, black trumpets, hedgehogs, yellowfeet mushrooms. And so Northern California and southwestern Oregon are the places to pick those. So we headed down probably sometime in January, and we camped in some forest areas. And we actually ran into a few tough customers, which I write about in the book. There was an incident at one point.
I want to hear about that. What happened?
As I had mentioned, you hear these stories of running gun battles in the woods and, you know, pickers who are packing heat and all that kind of stuff. And I really haven't encountered that. But in the middle of the night, while we were trying to sleep, we weren't picking mushrooms. And I don't think these guys happen to be mushroom pickers, but they came into our camping area with some big guns. And there was a lot of there were a lot of rounds going off.
Really?
And we had to make a hasty getaway.
Did they want your mushrooms?
You know, I think they were jacked up on something, and they might not have even known we were trying to sleep where we were. We were sort of hiding, our campsite, but we could hear them. They were nearby, and the bullets were flying, and we needed to get out of there and get out of there quick.
So this is not necessarily a safe occupation all the time anyway.
Well, I don't want to make it sound too dangerous. I mean, that was really one of the scarier things that happened. But, you know, when you're out there in the woods, in the unpoliced corners of the forests, you never know. You might run into a bear. You might run into an unsavory competitor. You just never know. And so those are some of the things that you have to deal with. But mostly, you know, it was just being outside in beautiful places, wandering through the woods, finding these edible treasures, and just being so excited with each find. I mean, it really is just like being a kid again on a treasure hunt in the woods. And that's one of the really appealing things about hunting mushrooms. And I think that's probably one of the motivating factors for the folks who do it for a living. It's just, you know, as one guy said to me, it sure beats a cubicle. And, you know, I mean, his livelihood fluctuates, you know, day to day, week to week. You never know when the mushroom flush is going to be off or on, and what the prices are going to be, because they go up and down with the market. And it's a tough way to make a living. It's hard work. You're walking miles every day carrying a heavy bucket or a pack, and dealing with the weather and all kinds of other things. But for people who want to work outside and be their own boss, you know, it's not bad.
Well, we're going to hear more about that adventure in just a moment. Hear more about the demand for mushrooms, too, and how much you might actually make as a mushroom hunter, as we talk with Langdon Cook about how mushrooms get from the forest to your plate. His new book is called The Mushroom Hunters: On the Trail of an Underground America.
How about you? Are you a mushroom forager? We'd like to hear from you if you go out hunting morels, at least, or maybe you've been around the country to hunt for different kinds of yummy wild mushrooms. Call in at 800-642-1234, or maybe you just like eating the things. What's your favorite kind and your favorite recipe? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll get to your calls right after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.